Welcome to Limelight's Behind the Green podcast, where we get the inside scoop on all things sustainability and talk to people prioritizing and building a greener tomorrow. I'm your host, Rebecca Smith, and today I'm joined by Valerie Schaefer Franklin, the co-founder of Artisans Cooperative and Walnut Studiolo, the leather crafting business that her and her husband own and manage. Valerie is on the board of directors for Artisans Cooperative, and she has over 20 years of professional experience as a nonprofit director, event planner, project manager for multi-million dollar renewable energy projects, and most importantly, 14 years running an artisan business as one half of the husband and wife leather crafting business that I mentioned before. She's also a freelance writer. Valerie taught me so much about her and her husband became artisans and how we as consumers can support artisans and better support local and small businesses, which is really just one of the many reasons that they've helped to co-found Artisans Cooperative, and you'll learn so much more about that in a second. She's also super easy to talk to, so this is a little longer than usual, but it is so, so worth it. I think you are really, really going to enjoy this one. So let's dive right in.
All right. Well, thank you, Valerie, so much for joining me today. I'd love if you could give a quick intro of yourself for everyone that's listening.
Sure. My name is Valerie Schaefer Franklin, and I am one half of a family leather crafting business called Walnut Studiolo. Me and my husband started this leather crafting business on Etsy in 2009. So we've actually been doing this for 14 years now. And we started our own website in 2012, and we were fortunate to get some early good press that helped us grow, and we expanded our product categories a little bit. We sell travel games, we sell handcrafted leather drawer pulls and kitchen handles, but we're best known for our leather bicycle accessories, which is how we got started. And so as our business has grown, we have grown with it, doing our own website, trying out other alternative marketplaces, bringing in our own audience, but also relying on marketplace audiences. And we've seen Etsy change a lot over the years since 2009. And then so in February 2022, when Etsy announced in the same week that they were increasing seller fees by 30% at the same week that they announced record profits the year before, it kind of struck a nerve with artisans and crafters like us everywhere. And what happened was we ended up sort of meeting each other on social media, and there was a strike organized. It was called the Etsy strike. And after the strike was over, and of course Etsy didn't change their fees after that, we decided a small group of us that we wanted to try to create something better, a marketplace that was owned by the people who love and use it, which is the beginning of Artisans Cooperative. And that's our new marketplace that we're selling Walnut Studiolo products on. I'm on the board of directors, and that's what brings me here today.
Awesome. Yeah, 30% is not small. That's a really big jump.
Yes.
yeah, so I am not surprised at all, right, that this sparked other conversations about how can we do this better. And I think something that we talk about a lot too at Limeloop is, you know, I mean, we are very focused on that environmentally friendly piece of sustainability, but that's also not the only piece, right? Sustainability is a very broad term that also talks about, you know, the good and how like you are being treated as an artisan on this platform, you know, and that's just, it's not sustainable if you're going to increase your prices like that and then not take into consideration, you know, what are the people that are using this really need? So I think this will be a really interesting, I think there's a lot we can talk about around this.
Yeah. I mean, sustainability is, you know, circular economy. It is circular everything. It's circular resources and circular materials. And part of, you know, artisans and crafters creating what is the value on Etsy. We're the ones creating the product ideas. We're the actual ones making the products. We're the ones warehousing it in our basements and our garages and actually doing the shipping ourselves. So, you know, we should be having more than just a seat at the table. I like to say, I want us to own the table so that when it comes down to experiencing profits from the cooperative, that goes back into the pockets of the artisans who made the value in the first place, rather than getting hoovered out to, you know, some billionaire's yacht somewhere.
Yeah, really. Yeah, no, that's that makes a lot of sense and is completely understandable. Tell me a little bit about the handmade market, right? So you and your husband had this leather making business. You've obviously, I mean, 2009, you said 14 years, that is a long time. And I mean, I love when I get to order something, I mean, candidly, I'm new to Artisans Cooperative. So like I have ordered stuff on Etsy in the last couple of years. But I love ordering stuff when I know it's going to be handmade. It's like when you go to a farmer's market or you're traveling and you're overseas and you jump into a market and you see these amazing products. And so tell me a little bit about how you preserve this community feel with these handmade, homemade items when you are on a marketplace, regardless of which one you're on.
Yeah, in some ways that is so easy because it is the artisans themselves. We are the authentic thing that makes, that has made Etsy special for all the years, you know, as people who have shopped on Etsy probably know and you've experienced. When it's an actual person like you and me actually packaging up what we make and sending it to someone and not like a warehouse where somebody's just shoving things into a box, you know, 100 an hour or something like that. We wrap each one up with pride and we put, you know, handwritten notes in there and sometimes little freebies or, you know, little stickers and stuff like that, because we really genuinely value our customers and the ability to do what we love. And these sales make that possible. And so, you know, by just working with genuine artisans, I think that you would be surprised at how it sort of feels like how Etsy did back in 2009. It used to be like that, where everything that you purchased did come from a genuine person who was packaging things up with care, and you weren't always so sure, like, oh, is this actually handmade or not? I feel like I need to research it and see. By having a handmade policy and by having a cooperative member owned organization, we're using the power of community to make sure that it stays authentic. So we work with each other. We have a handmade policy that not only defines what handmade means, which is artisans making authentic original goods under the workmanship of risk, which is a art craft philosophy concept that says that basically at some point in the process, you could ruin your work. And that's a kind of a hard thing to apply for like a bot to do, or for even, you know, like a call center's worth of employees to do. But it's something that if you're a jewelry maker and you see another person's jewelry, you would tend to know, like, oh, I've seen that charm. That is from Alibaba. That is not like actually handmade. And we know our own crafts and our own worlds the best. So by having real human eyes to help, you know, enforce the policy across the platform together, we're using that power of community to make sure that it actually stays handmade, because it's in our self-interest to do so. We want it to be only genuine, actual handmade goods on our site.
Yeah, I love that. It's also really refreshing to hear, because I think a lot of times when you think about brands and as they grow, you kind of, it's almost like this natural tendency to think about them as moving away from like, okay, how can we get less hands on it and more automation, right? Because that seems to be like, we've just put this in our brains as like, that is the next step. That is how it shows that you're this big company, but that's not necessarily the best way and the best approach. And so I actually like with, when you picture artisans growing, and like the next few years, next 10 years, what do you think is going to happen with some of the brands and some of the, well, I don't even want to say brands, with some of the artisans and like the makers that you have on the platform? You know, how do you kind of envision them growing too and being able to scale while still kind of keeping that community feel?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I have a few thoughts on that, actually. I mean, one is that, and we actually have a blog post about this on our blog that a fellow artisan wrote. And it's something that we've experienced ourselves as both leather crafters, and we also do mixed media. We work with wood, we work with some metal, you know, that type of thing. And as an artisan, it's really cool to watch other artisans get started and grow, because you can see them get better and you can see them refine their craft, and you can see that, like, okay, they're learning how to make it in batches now, and they're showing more consistency in this, and they're honing a style or they're honing a niche, and it's cool to watch. As an artisan, when you're doing that and you're growing and you're having more sales and you're having to figure out how do I make more of these things and meet customer expectations, you start finding these shortcuts. And my husband, Jeff, is the leather crafter here. And he'll say that he's made some of our products 10,000 times, but he still finds new ways to make it a little bit easier, or a new shortcut or something like that, by using a Sharpie instead of a pencil or whatever it is. And, you know, one example of that you actually can start achieving some more scale in-house by just strategic use of tools, which is totally allowed by our handmade policy. We're not like trying to say like, oh, this is like only when you produce your own materials from nature and use hand tools. The modern definition of handmade obviously means you have to use some power tools and machines. And that's okay. Like, you know, that's the only probably crafts that are actually made not using any tools are probably just basketry and pottery. And everybody else has to use tools to some extent. And why would it matter if it's a power drill or a hand drill? You still have to drill the wood.
Right.
There's no reason to make that hard. And so we did the same thing. We make, for example, these leather barrel bags for bicycles, and the ends are perfect wood circles. And the first probably 1,000 that we made, Jeff actually took a piece of wood and cut, you know, little corners and slowly sanded it into a perfect circle. I can tell you that is not a good use of time for a craftsman. And it made the things, you know, take more longer than it needed to, when it was still going to be a beautiful handmade product that was wrapped in leather and hand stitched and has a, you know, handcrafted opening on and everything that he assembles with hardware. So we eventually invested in a CNC routing machine so that we could cut the wood in perfect circles. And so those are the types of solutions that artisans come up with once they're given the gift, really, of sales and the need to rise to the occasion.
Yeah. I always think of that too, as like, it's a, you don't even really realize like, and problem, that's not the right word per se, but it's almost like you don't even realize that you have this problem until like you have all these other, like all these sales are coming in. You're like, whoa, wait, my time is so valuable. And like, I want to be able to fulfill all these. Now let's figure out how to make this a little more efficient, but still be able to do like the part that I love. And I'm putting myself in the shoes of a leather maker at the moment. I've never done anything with leather, so I truly don't know. But like, that's kind of how I envision that, right? It's like, you don't even realize that that's something you need to solve for until you're like, wait, this is amazing. And I really want to figure out how to make this more efficient and more economical also.
Yeah. I mean, that's where like geeking out about your tools is one of the most fun. I mean, one of the very early things we found that most leather crafters would know is a strap cutter, right? And so this is a very specially shaped knife called a draw knife that just allows you to cut perfect symmetrical strips of leather, and you can do all kinds of things with strips of leather. And so of course it makes sense that there's a tool that makes for easy, consistent cutting of straps. And that those are the types of things that as you develop your craft, you start adding more tools and experience, and you network with other ones. You know, we learned a lot from going to our leather crafting shop in the city, Portland, Oregon, and talking with the folks behind the counter there and learning about what's available so that we can use to make the craft easier. And it's exactly like you said, like, I think it wasn't until we got this like Christmas rush order one year where we were like, okay, we need to change like not only like how we do the tools or whatever, but our organizing our workspace, right? So that we have a dyeing station and we have a cutting station and we have a finishing station.
Yeah.
All of that is the joy of a small business, really.
Yep. We anytime that something like that happens, we call them champagne problems. That's what we call them. We're like, these are champagne problems, and they're great. Yeah. Challenging sometimes, but they're great. And I'd rather have them than not have them.
They are good problems to have.
They are good problems to have for sure. How did you and your husband get into leather making? Like, how'd that even start?
It actually started because of cycling, because of bicycles. So we lived in Portland, Oregon, which, you know, this was 2008, 2009. This was the Great Recession. We both had desk jobs in the city, and we both bike commuted, and we were both worried about losing our jobs. So before the recession really started to hit, and we were just enjoying our bicycles and cycling and living in this great town with an incredible cycling culture, we geeked out on our cycles, and we were decorating them like a lot of people decorate their cars, you know, putting wraps around their steering wheels or things on their rearview mirrors or whatever. We got into this book that showed vintage Italian cycles from the turn of the last century, like early 1900s. And we could see in these museum photos that these cool old Italian bicycles, leather work on their like handlebars and stuff like that, they looked beautiful today. And We just sort of connected that with the sort of where we live in the Western United States and the sort of idea of the bicycle being the modern horse, and this idea that, you know, the bicycle accessories we were making were like the tack that you would have for a horse, by having these leather saddlebags and leather wraps and leather straps. And so in a way, leather picked us. We were making things for our bicycle, things that we couldn't find, because we couldn't find actual real vegetable tan leather wraps like they made back in Italy in 1900, before the whole garment leather process, which is chrome tanning instead of oak bark tanning. So we couldn't find what we wanted, so we made it ourselves. And leather was the material that we learned to do it. Jeff is a graduate of the School of Architecture at the University of Oregon, and he would consider it sort of an umbrella design degree. So he came at it from a designer's point of view, and someone who went to an arts magnet school and loved making architectural models, and so understood material strengths and connections and how to design solutions. And that's not a great story probably for how we got to leather.
Oh, it's fascinating.
But leather kind of found us in a way.
Cool. Okay. This might be like a really dumb question. But being someone who's from the Pacific Northwest, I understand the weather up there very, very well. And living in Denver, where it's sunny all the time. I mean, I bike all the time, but it's sunny all the time. How does, and you know, like a lot of times when you get leather shoes and leather jackets, you know, they're like, be careful with rain, be careful with water and moisture. How do you deal with that in the Pacific Northwest?
It's not a problem. Actually, rain is not as hard on leather as the sun is. This is literally the exact same leather they use in horse tack. So it is meant to be outdoors and sweated on. And, you know, obviously, just like with horse tack, you want to bring it back inside and dry it off and brush it off sometimes. Yeah. Leave it outside, you know, 24/7. That's never good, whether it's in the sun or the rain. And we also, and this is part of, you know, artisans being scrappy and crafty, I made our own version of a leather care dressing. I, you know, like to make my own sort of like, you know, cosmetics and, you know, soaps and stuff like that. And so I made a leather base, a very basic old fashioned leather care recipe, using, you know, beeswax and oils. And it was actually a historic recipe from the Library of Congress that like New England fishermen used on their boots. So no weird ingredients, no modern, you know, chemicals or anything like that. And so that helps when you apply a leather care dressing, you know, once a year or something like that. But we've seen leather do worse in like when it's like, you know, in the desert in Arizona outside in the sun all day.
I could see that. Okay. Interesting. Logically, when you explain it like that, I'm like, that makes sense, especially because every time I've been on a horse, I mean, that horse is very sweaty afterwards, right? After having something on it, same with you, like it takes a lot of work to ride a horse. So, okay.
Yeah, logically, you can see the salt form and stuff like that. Yeah. You just have to brush those salts off and, you know, it's the same thing. And just like, actually with the leather handlebar wraps, for example, the more, and you probably have noticed this if you have ridden horses with like reins and stuff, wherever you're touching the leather, it really doesn't need any help at all because the oils in your hands are conditioning. They're doing what that leather care dressing would do just by doing your thing and using your hands and touching the leather. So using the leather is one of the best ways to keep it in good shape. And so leather handlebar wraps on a bicycle where you're literally having your hands on them the whole time is one of the best ways to keep them in good shape.
Yeah. Talk about being sustainable right there. Yeah. Just use it.
Yeah. Just ride your bike.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Learn something new every day for sure. I want to pivot back to talking a little bit about like Etsy and some of the bigger tech companies. And like, when you think about ordering online and shipping, right, I instinctively, I just think about Etsy and I think about Amazon. We're just two more things that kind of get ingrained to us. I think of Etsy, right, for more homemade items. And I think of Amazon for literally anything and everything else. And it's just ingrained in us at this point. But they, both of them do things differently. They both have different pros, different cons, of course, depending on the way you're looking at them. But since they are really these big tech giants in the space, you know, that you're in, how do you really make artisans stand out? And like, how do you really kind of bring new customers over to you and to your business versus kind of going to the ones that most people, right, kind of think of first, unfortunately?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so, yeah, Amazon and Etsy are actually both marketplaces that I've put Walnut Studiolo products on in the past. So I understand the experience across all three platforms. And like you said, Artisans Cooperative is really, it's brand new. So we're just getting our feet under us. I mean, I think that we know, you know, Amazon set the bar for fast free shipping, and they did it like planning to take losses for years so they could attain this sort of monopolistic share over the shopping market. We can't compete with that. Right. Etsy can't even compete with that. They are the sort of in their own category on that. And honestly, as a, you know, sometime Amazon shopper myself, I live rurally. I have to sometimes.
Yeah.
I think they're even having trouble keeping up with that promise. I think people are starting to notice that that 2-day guarantee is not really 2 days anymore. So they created, in some ways they created a monster. It's been, you know, really great for consumers, really hard for small businesses to keep up with. Etsy tries to sort of create a more homogenous experience for the customers by creating these policies that are really hard on artisans and sellers. One of them, for example, is their what they call the customers a free shipping guarantee of $35, but actually just means that the sellers pay the shipping. There's no such thing as free shipping. Somebody has to pay for it somewhere. And right. $35 is a number that Etsy picked. And it's not like we can pick a, like for my own website, we have a free shipping guarantee over $65 because that's what makes sense for our products. On Etsy, it's $35 or nothing. So as artisans and small micro businesses who are trying to be supportive of fellow micro businesses, we feel like we need to reach out to those ethical customers who genuinely want to support genuine artisans making actually handmade things. And, you know, I can tell you from experience that people don't go on Amazon to look for a handcrafted leather cribbage board.
Really? <I'm shocked.
laughs> Yeah, they, you know, even if you put it up on there, they're just not, that's not where they're going to go shop for that. And I think that ultimately that's how Etsy got its start. And Artisans Cooperative is sort of going into the hole that Etsy's leaving by being less focused on handmade and supportive of artisans like they used to. So when Etsy first started, it was like, oh, this is so cool. This is like a marketplace that's like directly connecting me with artists. Now it's not so much. Both customers and artisans realize that there are too many people who think they are buying from Etsy rather than buying from Jeff and Val in Oregon. And so, you know, this is it's an alternative. It's not going to be a replacement. I don't imagine. It's just going to be an alternative for the people who are seeking out those more unique things. And I do think that as Etsy's policies make things harder and harder for artisans, you may have heard about the whole payment reserves thing. I think at the point when they start withholding people's money, artisans are going to start making choices about where it makes sense for them to sell their goods. And if they're not making money from it, why be on Etsy?
Right.
and that is one of the reasons why we've had a lot of interest from artisans in joining our marketplace. And I think that our artisans punch above their weight. You know, one of the things that got Etsy started and I think is going to get us started is the fact that all of these artisans, we're all small business owners. We've all had to claw and fight our way to get our own customers and create our own, you know, products and designs and value propositions and all of that. And so we bring with us our universes, and by pooling our resources as a cooperative, by all sharing our information with our customers and our family and our friends, that's just how, you know, we can be stronger as a community to be a viable alternative. When Etsy went public in 2015, the CEO at the time, Chad Dickerson, was quoted saying something like, the remarkable growth in our users is due to sellers promoting their own shops. And so we're basically doing that all over again. We're kind of repeating history. And I think that there's a lot of us who miss the old Etsy. And that makes a lot of intuitive sense to us that, like, we just want to turn the clocks back and be how Etsy used to be. And one of the ways that Etsy went wrong was by getting investors who had different priorities and who were running the business for themselves and not for the actual buying and selling of crafts. They were doing it for profits, not for the reasons that we all want this service to exist. And so we believe that the cooperative model will make the difference and prevent mistakes from happening, repeats and mistakes happening, and also prevent us from going the way of other small Etsy alternatives that have popped up over the years that are also investor owned and not cooperative owned. We're the first ones to try to do this as a co-op owned by the members themselves. And, you know, nobody's done it before, so we'll see, but that's what we think will bring our competitive edge, is that desire to actually help artisans and have an authentic shopping experience where you're not worried about whether or not it's actually handmade and if it's a dropshipper or not.
Right. There's definitely something too about, like, you can feel, even I personally feel like, even online, like, you can feel when there's, like, love behind a product, right? When someone's, like, putting love and putting energy and attention behind it, like, there's definitely a different kind of feel that you get online. And, like, I know, like, I'm not the most frequent person on social media, which is terrible because I'm in marketing and I should be. But, like, one of the things that I love to do is, like, I have a couple of friends that have some small businesses, and they put videos of these time lapses of them creating the macrame art that they do, or putting this, like, homemade granola butter into jars, even if it's in a massive warehouse, and you see the CEOs and co-founders, they're doing all this work, right? Even though they have a huge team behind them also. And it's, like, it's really, like, you can definitely see the love that, like, they put into it, and it puts that authenticity and that, you know, like, genuine feel out there. And I think that's super important. And I'm thinking about this just because when you had said, you know, you miss how the old Etsy was, that, like, really sparked that for me on that, like, it's not just about, obviously it's about money, because you do have to make money and live, like, yeah, to be able to, you know, live comfortably. But there is definitely this also, like, hey, I love what I'm doing and I want to be able to share that with the world, versus just, I'm doing this just to make money.
Absolutely. These sales fuel your passion. It allows you to buy that next tool, you know, yeah, and then continue, yeah, investing in your business and your skills, and allow someone to follow that passion and see how far it'll go. Because, you know, without that, ultimately it just becomes a hobby, and people do amazing things with hobbies. And I am all for not monetizing your joy. That's a saying I saw somewhere and I can't take credit for it. But the idea that just because you like quilting doesn't mean that you need to sell quilts. But craft is the refuge of the disadvantaged, right? It's the economic refuge for anybody who struggles in the traditional workplaces and in the traditional corporate ladders, women in particular. We tend to fall back on crafts, and this is an ancient historical thing. This is not something new. It's just that online platforms are making it possible to have that be an all-encompassing career or a family business.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really good point, I think, to bring up too, right? Both on, you don't have to, like, sell your hobbies. Like, you can have a hobby just for fun. Like, you can totally do craft just for fun. But there is definitely, I feel like, a lot of the artisans and craft makers out there, you do typically see a lot more that are much more women run, women owned, women founded, women made. And that's actually, I don't think it's a bad thing though either, right? It's like, women are finding a place that they love and something that they really find joy in. And I think it's a good thing, I think, to recognize it, right? Because you see kind of that it's a little more heavily on this side of full of women and that feminine energy, but it's also, like, it's nice, you know, that there's good places for everyone to go. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And the hope is that unlike gig work, you know, selling your handmade goods and building your online business on a marketplace becomes a self-fulfilling, sustaining livelihood for yourself or your family. And I just, I count myself as very lucky that my husband and I were able to make it work through this, you know, world of online marketplaces, and then, you know, eventually adding your own website and trying to grow and change. Craftsmanship is not going away. You know, it actually, I think in many ways is more needed than ever and more appreciated than ever, because there's so much fakeness because of AI. It just shows our value rather than it being something to compete against.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a good point. Yeah, such a good point, especially considering we are all like glued to our phones, glued to technology, glued to watching other people do stuff versus actually like physically using our hands, right, to do something besides scrolling. That's not what I mean at all. I don't want to talk about scrolling. where do you hope to see the future of online sales around the like handmade market go?
Yeah, I hope that we continue to grow and grow and create more market share for artisans with our, you know, lower fees and simple, transparent structure and the ability to, as we become break even and then profitable, to redistribute dividends to our members. I think that, you know, this is an interesting time in history. You know, the interest rates are going up and there's lots of worries about what's going on in the world right now. But I just believe that the personal connection that people find through buying art and craft is actually something that makes this world a little bit better. And whether it's just like literally like holding, you know, a piece of pottery that you can feel the artisan's fingerprints on as a fidget fidget thing or whatever, that personal connection that you feel by touching someone's art makes it one of your few prized possessions. So I certainly hope that people start you know, as times get tougher, making choices to buy quality rather than quantity. I think it's a generational change that is already happening. I think the older generations, my parents being one of them, you know, tend to be like, oh, if it breaks, I'll just buy a new one. Whereas my generation tends to be more like, oh, I really want to buy that, like, you know, whole cloth type of jean and live with it for 20 years and make it my own. So I see nothing but upside. I just hope that we can grow together and continue to do this and try and prove that the cooperative model will be the thing that makes a difference and lifts us all up.
Yeah, no, I love that. That also, you know, that makes me think a little bit about like tying back to sustainability, like we talked about briefly before at the very beginning of this conversation, where it is definitely a generational change and kind of shift in perspective, where like in the past, a lot of people have said, you know, it breaks, just buy a new one. And really, it's like, okay, one, that's not sustainable, one for your wallet or just for the environment in general, when you think about shipping and you think about the making of it and virgin materials and stuff, right? And it's just, it's not a good sustainable kind of focus. And so before I let you go, I want to ask a little bit too about, you know, what you think around sustainability with handmade goods and with artisans and makers and what that really looks like and how we can really make sure, you know, that we are thinking about that kind of environmentally friendly piece, as well as, you know, the economics behind it.
Absolutely. Beyond the economic justice and the circular economy-ness of just the artisans owning their own businesses and cooperatives having the moral authority and the democratic authority to make decisions that might choose people or planet over profits, unlike the typical, legal, you know, publicly traded structure. They have to choose profits or they could get sued. Cooperatives right. are owned and run by their members, and we vote on what we want to do. And sometimes that might be unorthodox. And most of the time, as what I've seen is that studies have shown that cooperatively, democratically managed companies do make more environmental decisions. And there are lots of great cooperatives out there that are examples of this. We're not the first online cooperative. We're not, you know, there's a ton of great large-scale cooperatives doing this. But Also, the just buying from micro businesses and artisans, I think there's a unique environmental story and sustainability in just the ability to make sure that people out there know how to repair things. And if people are learning skills and crafts and honing them and getting better, that improves our collective capacity to keep things out of landfills and repair things. There was an article I read some time ago that said replacement parts are the new luxury. You know, if it's a nice enough piece that you can buy replacement parts and you don't have to just, oh, it breaks, I'll buy a new one, but I can repair it. Either easily or by contacting the company to repair it for me, or the artisan, you know, can you fix this hole in my sweater? This piece of hardware fell off my leather, or can I have a set of replacement cribbage pegs so I don't have to buy a whole new board to get the pegs? For example, the cribbage is a card game we sell.
Playing it all the time. My grandpa was like, if you don't know how to play cribbage, you're useless to me, basically. I'm like, okay.
It's so funny because it is kind of regional, and in the Pacific Northwest, everyone plays cribbage.
We all play cribbage.
Yeah. And some places in the country, people have never heard of it.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm from a Euchre family myself. So
my boyfriend's from a Euchre family, and I don't know anything about Euchre. So,
but what I think that artisans bring, to this, that's unique from many other good companies who are doing great things, Patagonia, whatever, who are big. And Patagonia is a great example, actually, of another company who does repairs within reason, is this prevention of the landfill by skill building. And so making sure that you're supporting artisans who are learning how to be leather crafters, learning how to be tailors, learning how to be knitters, keeps us all having more options to hone our skills and repair and keep things out of the landfill.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's great, you know, because I think a lot of people, you know, when they hear sustainable, they're not necessarily thinking about, okay, how can I, if I buy something, how do I repair it, right? They're not, that's not really the first thing that comes to their mind. So I think that's a really good reminder just to share all the time with everyone that, like, you can repair what you have and make it just as good as it was before. And then continue to just reuse and reuse and reuse versus getting rid of it and buying something completely new that you're just going to end up tossing again.
Absolutely. You know, it's like,
so,
and what is the three phases? Is it reduce, reuse, recycle?
Yeah.
You know, reduce. Can you use what you've got negative? Yeah. Make it do before you have to look at recycling. So that's part of, like, thinking about it in that hierarchy. First, can I buy things that are repairable, that have replacement parts?
Yeah, we a lot of times, right, when you see that, you see it as like this circle of reduce, reuse, recycle. We kind of like to think of it as like this upside down triangle of, like, reduce is huge. We want to reduce. This is where you start, then you reuse, and then if you have to, you recycle, but we keep it really, really small. And it's like, if you must, because most of what we recycle doesn't even get recycled, right? We have a massive recycling problem, especially in the United States.
Especially with plastics.
it's a very bad scenario that we need to figure out how to solve, and hopefully we will at some point.
Well, I think your parenthood sounds like the right start.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining. This has been so nice to have you. Such an easy conversation. I would love if you could tell everyone where they can find you online, as well as Artisans Cooperative, and your leather making, Walnut Studiolo.
Yeah.
I don't want to say it wrong. Did I say that wrong?
No, you didn't, but it's okay. Studiolo is an Italian architecture term for a little studio. And because Jeff was an architect, we did that to differentiate ourselves from Walnut Studio. And it's kind of an obscure term, but you did it.
I love it.
I would love for people to think about buying ethically and handmade this holiday season by going to Artisans Cooperative. It's, our website is artisans.coop, artisans plural .coop. And you can find on there over 100 artisans already. We hope that other artisans will join us. We hope that anybody that wants to see a good cooperative alternative that supports artisans consider becoming a member. We're a multi-stakeholder cooperative of artisans, supporters, and someday staff. And you'll be surprised at the good variety of art and craft that we already have up there, just having launched 3 weeks ago. We're really proud of all of our artisans. I'm on there. My husband and I are on there as Walnut Studiolo. We're also on our website, walnutstudiolo.com, where we sell leather crafting goods in travel games, kitchen and drawer handles, leather wraps, and leather bicycle accessories and some other fun things. It's just been a delight to be here. And I just want to thank you for helping share our message and get the word out about artisans trying to build their careers and find an authentic way to present themselves to shoppers.
Awesome. I'll make sure that all of those links and any other links too that we want to share, I'll make sure that those are in the show notes, so it's really easy for everyone to find. Yeah. And that's definitely somewhere that I'll be checking out for any kind of holiday shopping that I need to do now also. So thank you so much for your time. It has been a pleasure having you on here.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks for listening in to Limelink Behind the Green podcast. If you want to listen to episodes, visit anchor.fm/The Lime Loop, and we'll see you in here next time.